Gopi Janna Balaba Giribarin Hari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana. Jamuna Tiram Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Gopi Janna Balaba Giribarin Hari Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana Jamuna Tiram Banachari Jamuna Tiram Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Sanskrit,
please. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So this morning we'll review the entire first canto, and it begins with this verse, 111. This is, if you want to memorize the Srimad Bhagavatam, this is the verse you must start with. So let us begin today. Janmad yasya yaton bayad itaratas charteshwa bigyaswarat. Yasya yaton bayad itaratas charteshva bigyasvara tene brahma hridaya adikavaye muhyanti yatsurayaha tejo vari mridang yatavini mayo yatratri sargom risha Imridam yata vini mayo yatra tri sargom risha dhamna swena sada nirasta kuhakang satyam parang di mahi
swena sada
kuhakang satyam parang jan madhyasya yaton vayad itaratas charteshwa bigyaswarad Tene brahma hridaya adikavaye muhyanti yatsurayaha. Tejo vari mridang yata vinimayo yatra tri sargom risha. Hamna swena sada nirasta kuhakam satyang parang di mahi.
Hamna swena sada Mahimahi.
Anyone else like to chant?
Jan madhyasya yaton vayad yataratas charteshwar vidyaswarat. Tene brahma hridaya adikavaye mulkyanti yat surayah. Tejo vari mridam yata vinimayo yatra chi sargom mrishad. Dhamna swena sada nirasta kuhakam satyam param dhimahi.
Anyone else?
Jan madhyasya yaton vayad itaratas charteshva vidyaswarat. Tene brahma hridaya adikavaye muhyanti yat surayaha. Tene vari mridam yata vinimayo yatra tri sargom risha. Dhamna swena sada nirasa kuakam satyam param dhimahi.
Okay. Anyone else? A couple of words I want to point out for your vocabulary. Swarat. What is swarat? Independent, yes, self-contained. So this first verse is about Krishna. Second verse is about Bhagavatam, and third verse is about how to understand Bhagavatam. So this verse is all about Krishna. So he is swarat, independent. What does it mean? Tene brahma hrida adikavaye. Yeah, what is hrida? Heart, right. So he imparted brahma, the spiritual knowledge, into the heart of Adikavaye, who happens to be Lord Brahma. Let's see, and Muhyanti, anyone know the meaning of that word? Yeah, it means bewildered. Or loose. So Muhyanti yat Suraya. Who are the Surayaha? Right. So even the great demigods are bewildered by the material energy. Which is comprised of Tejo Vari Mridam. It means, earth, water, and fire. So this illusory energy bewilders even the demigods. And finally, what is Dhamna? What is the Dham? Yes, so Krishna is always in his Dham. In spite of creating this whole material world, he stays in Vrindam. Dhamna Swena. Sada. What is Sada? Always. Satyam Param. Yes, absolute truth, right. And finally, Dhimahi. What is that? Meditate. So I meditate on. So he lists all the qualities of Krishna like this, and then he says that. So I meditate upon him, the absolute truth. Let's just read the translation together, shall we? O my Lord, Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Sri Krishna, because he is the absolute truth and the primeval cause of all causes of the creation, sustenance, and destruction of the manifested universes, directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations, and he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he only who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion. As one is bewildered by the illusory representation of water seen in fire or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universes, temporarily manifested by the reactions of the three modes of nature, appear factual, although they are unreal.
I therefore meditate upon him, or Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, which is forever free of the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. Okay, put that down. All right, so let's turn to page 113. These are the summaries of the 19 chapters of the first canto, combined into 9, I think. So some of the chapters are on multiple themes. Sorry, 12 chapters. Okay, so I'd like to just spend our class today reading these so we can kind of refresh our memories and then raising any questions or discussion as we go from chapter to chapter. Is that all right? All right, so who would like to start? Brandon, you want to start? Let's just use the good mic. Yes.
Hare Krishna. Hare. Okay, just want to make sure.
Starting? Okay. Chapter 1, the sages turn to Sutta. The chapter encompasses chapters 1 through 3 in the original text. The Bhagavata's narrator opens the work with the classic Sanskrit mantra, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om invokes the auspiciousness. Namo means I bow. Bhagavate refers to Krishna, the speaker of Bhagavad Gita, who is Bhagavan, the all-opulent one. And Vasudevaya refers to the son of Vasudev, Krishna's father, or the all-pervading Lord. The invocation continues with elegant praise of Lord Krishna in the Bhagavata, which rewards the pure-hearted reader with permanent relief from the material misery. Vyasa, the author, spoke this book to his son Sukadev, who later repeated it for everyone's benefit. The invocation verses compare Bhagavata to a mango, and Sukadev to a parrot, who pecks it open and thereby intensifies its natural sugars. In Sanskrit, sukha means parrot.
Our narrator takes us back 5,000 years to a time when saintly persons regularly performed sacrifices according to Vedic rites. At one gathering, the atmosphere was tense due to Lord Krishna's recent disappearance from Earth. The sages knew the Vedic cosmic calendar that the age of Kali, quarrel and hypocrisy had just begun, threatening all spirituality. Feeling uncertain, the sages appoint Sudha Goswami as their mentor. After seating him on a dais, the sages ask him to explain the reference to higher authorities, how spirituality will continue without Krishna. Sudha answers by offering to recite the Bhagavat, exactly as he heard from Sukadev at a previous assembly. Offering respects to the Lord, the author, and the goddess of learning, he begins with a summary of the Bhagavat glossary. These cogent verses, among the most famous in the text, describe the step-by-step process of loving God and shedding materialism.
The rest of the chapter introduces fundamental spiritual technology. Readers of the Bhagavad Gita will recognize references to the three modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. We also learn that Krishna creates the material world for the sake of those souls originally loving his loving paths who seek enjoyment without him. Such misused independence leads the soul to suffer the physical miseries of birth and death. To relieve them, Krishna appears within his material creation as the super soul sitting in everyone's heart. He also appears in countless incarnations. Sutta piques his audience's interest by naming Bhagavata as Krishna's literal incarnation.
Some of Krishna's following incarnations appear in later cantos of the Bhagavata. Kumaras, Varaha, Narada, Naranarayan, Kapila, Atri, Yajna, Rishabha, Prithu, Matsya, Korma, Nishrimha, Vamana, Parashuram, Vyasadev, Ramachandra, Balaram, Krishna, Buddha, and Kalki.
He asked who's Atri.
Chapter 2, Saint Narada appears. We meet Shaunaka, spokesman for the assembly of sages, inquiring from Suta. Shaunaka asks Suta to describe how Bhagavatam came to be written and how the author's son Shukdev learnt it. In reply, Suta tells the story of Vyasa. Living as a simple sage on the bank of a holy river, Vyasa found his meditations disturbed by ominous premonitions. At that ancient time, human memory was so sharp that writing was unnecessary. Foreseeing how the coming Kali age would enfeeble people's brain, Vyas resolved to write down the Vedic literature.
The word Vedic comes from the Sanskrit Veda, meaning knowledge. Krishna spoke the original Veda to Brahma, the first inhabitant of the universe. Starting with this seminal work, Vyas divided the Veda into four sections, Rig, Sama, Artva, and Yajur, each suitable for a particular class of people. As a supplement, he added a series of historical texts recounting events since creation. These histories, or Itihasas, include the Mahabharata and several Puranas. After completing this tough job, Vyasa found himself despondent. Suddenly his guru, Narada, appeared on the riverbank. In the course of their discussion, Narada identifies Vyasa's problem as a lack of focus on Krishna. Narada distinguishes Krishna-conscious knowledge from all others by telling Vyasa a story from his life.
As a young boy, Narada happened to learn about Krishna from visiting sages. Later, when he was orphaned, he sat on an isolated forest and saw Krishna in meditation. Krishna vanished and young Narada was unable to see him again. Krishna then assured the child that he would be fine by simply remembering him. Narada lived out his life accordingly, and when he died, he attained a permanent spiritual body, enabling him to travel and teach everywhere. Satisfied, Vyasa resolves to write a text exclusively about Krishna, the Bhagavad Puran.
The sages want to know, how is the Bhagavatam spoken? How did it come? Why is this Bhagavatam so important that it's called the literary incarnation of God? He's listing all the incarnations because they've asked, how will spirituality continue in Kali Yuga? And Sutta says, oh, well, the Bhagavatam is the literary incarnation of God for Kali Yuga. So they say, well, how did it come to be spoken? That's amazing. So then he tells the story of Vyas. And Vyas tells the story of Narada, who is his guru. And through the rest of the Bhagavatam, all 12 cantos, Narada appears regularly, whenever there's a problem. So some people call the Bhagavatam the glorification of Narada by Vyas.
That's right. They don't want to.
Wrapping up his initial discussion of the Bhagavatam's history, Sutra explains why Vyasa's son Sukadev took an interest in the book, despite already being a realized soul. Suta next turns his attention to the long story behind the king to whom Sukadev first recited the Bhagavatam.
Before we go on, does anyone remember this verse that is just briefly mentioned there? They ask, why was Sukadev interested in Bhagavatam? He was already self-realized. To which Right, Vyasa replies, Atmaramas Chamuniyam, the famous Atmaram verse which Lord Chaitanya discussed.
No, you're right.
As related in the Mahabharata, the pious king Pandu held the ancient throne of the world, located in the capital of Hastinapur, present-day Delhi. Pandu's older brother, Dhritarashtra, would have been king were it not for his blindness. When Pandu died, Dhritarashtra's son snatched the throne from Pandu's sons. This led to a battle of Kurukshetra, a devastating and tragic war between the cousins.
Pandu's five sons, the Pandavas, headed by wise Yudhishthir, included the powerful Bhima, the great archer Arjuna, and the handsome twin Nakula and Sahadev. In the battle, they destroyed the army of their chief enemy, Duryodhan, Dhritarashtra's eldest son. Among the many killed by the Pandavas was Drona, the much-beloved military teacher of both groups of cousins. Drona was a Brahmana, a priest and a teacher, obliged by fate to help Duryodhan. As Duryodhan lay dying, Aswatthama, Drona's son, brought him the severed heads of Pandava's five young sons. The night the battle was over, Aswatthama had snuck in their quarters and decapitated the boys in their sleep.
Even the selfish Duryodhan rebuked Aswatthama for what he had done to the Pandava's children. On hearing the unbearable news, Arjuna turned to his wife, Draupadi, mother of the five slain boys, and promised Aswatthama's head. Aswatthama was already running away, but Arjuna, with the help of his charioteer Krishna, was about to catch him. Aswatthama decided to release his ultimate weapon, the Brahmastra, a mystical nuclear bomb invoked by mantra and capable of precise targeting. Although Aswatthama was unworthy and could not control it properly, the somewhat indulgent Drona had given him the weapon for his personal protection in emergencies.
A quick note. This is where we first see who in the Bhagavata? Krishna. And what's he doing? Driving the chariot of Arjuna, right? Just like in the Bhagavad Gita. So we first see him just taking up the same position, but the Bhagavatam is the graduate study, postgraduate study of Bhagavad Gita. Right, the end of the war. So, still, Krishna is serving his devotee.
As Aswatthama's Brahmastra hurtled towards them, Krishna directed Arjuna to answer it with his own. When the two glaring mystical weapons collided, it appeared for a moment as if the entire universe would ignite. However, Arjuna was able to withdraw both Brahmastras. He then captured Aswatthama. Krishna and Bhima urged Arjuna to kill Aswatthama. But the soft-hearted Draupadi sympathized with Aswatthama's mother and asked for his release. With Krishna's hint, Arjuna cut the hair and mystic jewel from Aswatthama's head. Humiliated and deprived of his powers, Aswatthama was thus killed and not killed at the same time.
After driving off Aswatthama, the Pandavas, the despondent Dhritarashtra, their families and others joined to perform Vedic rituals for the countless warriors fallen in the battle. Krishna comforted the mourners with gentle words full of spiritual wisdom. Then as Krishna was turning to leave, the young princess Uttara ran to his side, crying for help. The shameless Aswatthama had thrown another Brahmastra, targeting the embryo in her womb, the unborn son of Abhimanyu, Arjuna's slain son. The embryo was the Pandav's sole surviving heir, and Aswatthama wanted to finish the family line. This attack caught everyone by surprise. Although Krishna had promised not to fight in the war, he promptly defended the unborn child with his miraculous mystic powers.
Four, Queen Kunti petitions Lord Krishna. Kunti, the widow of Pandu and mother of the five Pandava sons, watched with wonder as Krishna saved her unborn great-grandson. Although her own sons had conquered the world and were ready to protect her, Kunti realized that Krishna was her only true protector. As Krishna prepared to leave, Kunti felt anxious and spoke to Krishna, her nephew, in heartfelt prayers, long noted for their poetry and grace. Kunti recognizes Krishna as all-powerful, yet skillfully acting as an ordinary person for the purpose of teaching spiritual truth to learned sages. She asked how a simple woman she can understand his elevated teachings. Expressing her inability, she simply praises Krishna and his pastimes as a cowherd boy. She compares him in various ways to a blooming lotus flower, the Vedic emblem of beauty.
Kunti then recounts the many times Krishna protected her and her sons. She concludes that it is better to live through disasters with Krishna than enjoy peace without him. She points out that Krishna is more interested in those who have shortcomings than those confidently committed to material advancement, for he is above any material considerations. Krishna, she continues, blesses everyone, but some ascribe their problems to him, problems that are in fact a result of the interactions of godless people. At the same time, she acknowledges his actions are inconceivable. As an example, she cites events from his childhood, such as his mother tying him up when he was naughty. How, asks Kunti, can we reconcile powerful Krishna being bound with his mother's rope? She concludes that it is inconceivable, as are the reasons for his very appearance on earth.
Some explain, Kunti says, that Krishna comes to exalt the Yadu dynasty in which he appears. Others say he comes to fulfill the prayers of his parents, Vasudeva and Devaki, for a divine son. Others say Lord Brahma saw earth in peril and prayed for Krishna to save it. Still others say Krishna comes to save materialists from hell. Kunti concludes that one must simply enjoy singing Krishna's names and talking about him.
Kunti appeals to Krishna to stay, fearing his absence would destroy their prosperous kingdom. In a powerful final plea, she begs the Lord to cut off her affection for her family so that her love can flow to him exclusively like the Ganges to the sea. Krishna, pleased with these prayers, spends some time to pacify Kunti and the other ladies present. Then Yudhishthir, also fearing his absence, presents Krishna with his own dilemma. Since the devastating battle has resulted in his ascendancy to the throne, Yudhishthir feels burdened by the deaths of so many warriors. Thinking of their widows reduces him to tears, and he fears the rest of his life will be stained with sin and guilt.
Five. Bhishma speaks from his deathbed. Seeking guidance, Yudhishthira, at Krishna's urging, goes to Bhishma, his powerful grandfather who is dying nearby on the battlefield. The righteous Bhishma, obliged to fight for Duryodhana, terrorized the Pandavas' forces at the battle's outset until Arjuna mortally wounded him. Blessed to be able to choose his time of death, Bhishma lies his body riddled with arrows, waiting for an auspicious moment to die. Krishna, accompanied by many sages, arrives at Bhishma's bed. Yudhishthira and his encourage join him. Entourage join him. Bhishma is pleased to see them all, especially Krishna. He comforts Yudhishthira, reflecting on his victory and morality with fond praises. Time says Bhishma imposes suffering on all, even the pious Pandavas. He urges Yudhishthira to vigorously rule the kingdom and give up his crippling remorse.
Yudhishthira asks Bhishma to tell him how to rule.
And Bhishma explains that good kings first deal with the citizen's character, and he lists 9 basic qualifications for righteous human life. Bhishma then outlines the Varnashram social system, detailing both the 4 Varnas, occupational orders, and the 4 Ashram, spiritual orders, needed for peaceful, organized society. Thinking Bhishma, Yudhisthira asks how to apply Varnashram principles. Bhishma says that the king must uphold spirituality by using tax revenue to support and encourage priests of all persuasions to educate society in God-centered principles. At the same time, the king must be very strong in punishing criminals.
That'd be nice.
Yes.
What if you could just have a career as a Brahmin and never have financial worries? You know, you'd always be supported if you just focused on studying the scriptures and teaching them. Would you sign up for that career? Chintamani would be a professional kirtanier.
Yudhisthira digs deeper into the question of spirituality. Bhishma further explains that a good king helps his citizens learn how to overcome bad habits and passion. And women, more powerful than men, says Bhishma, and therefore especially responsible for chastity. In summary, Bhishma says that anyone who sincerely serves and pleases God develops every good quality. Having answered Yudhisthira's question, Bhishma now focuses entirely on Krishna, who is standing by his side. Gazing at Krishna with his final words, Bhishma glorifies Krishna in his pastimes.
6. Krishna returns to Dwaraka. Having attended to his pure devotees Arjuna, Kunti, Yudhishthira and Bhishma, Krishna finally leaves the battlefield of Kurukshetra and the Kuru capital Hastinapur for his own Yadu capital in Dwaraka. Krishna's departure rouses intense emotions in Hastinapur. The Pandavas and the other royalties nearly faint, and the other palace residents are dazed at the thought. The ladies of the palace, showing both modesty and eagerness, ran to the rooftop to shower Krishna with flowers. As the people below glorify Krishna with choice prayers and various music instruments, the ladies discuss Krishna among themselves.
He is God, they decide, and pure souls leave this world and go to him at death. He creates and destroys the universe, and he also comes personally to destroy demoniac kings. At the same time, he sports in Braj and reigns over the Yadus in Dwarka. How fortunate are his queens in Dwarka and his milkmaid consorts in Braj. Overhearing these discussions, Krishna smiles pleasingly at the ladies. Yudhisthira and others trail after him for a great distance until Krishna finally convinces them to return to Hastinapur.
Another festival awaits Krishna's return to Dwarka. Hearing him announce his arrival with his conch, the residents run out to greet Krishna with joyous prayers. They praise Krishna as mother, father, guru, and God, cursing his absence and reveling in his return. Gardens and lakes make the city of Dwarka naturally beautiful, but the citizens enhance its beauty even more. They celebrate Krishna's return by festooning the houses and streets with auspicious articles and scents. The palace residents rush to see him, as do scribes, priests, prostitutes, and artisans. Krishna takes time to greet everyone individually, charming them all. Although they often see Krishna, everyone feels stunned by his beauty as he strides to his father's house.
Inside, Krishna respectfully greets his father Vasudev and mother Devaki. He then enters each of his 16,000 palaces simultaneously, expanding himself by his limitless mystic powers. Within each palace, Krishna's wives send forward their sons to embrace him. Each wife thinks Krishna hers alone. Home at peace after the Kurukshetra war, Krishna now appears to be an ordinary householder. Yet, he is unaffected by lust for his gorgeous wives or attachment to his opulence of Dwarka.
You know that when the gopis were with Krishna and they were thinking, oh, Krishna is here just to be with me, then Krishna disappeared. When his wives are thinking this, he's staying with them. It's a different rasa. It's a different swakya and parakya. Swakya is a legal conjugal relationship, married. Parakya is illegal. And in the material world, the legal is higher than the illegal. But that's a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, okay? Like the reflection of a tree in the lake. So the top branches in the lake appear to be the lowest thing. So that's the illicit sex in the material world. But in the spiritual world, the relationship between Krishna and the gopis is the paramount, because they gave up everything, any moral consideration, any ethical consideration, any reputation, to be with Krishna. So the wives did feel that Krishna was theirs exclusively. Krishna gave that opportunity only briefly to the gopis. And the rest of the time they were just in separation from him. But the wives had Krishna, and they, because he manifested himself in each palace, every wife thought, oh, Krishna's here with me, and she didn't even worry about the other wife. Yes, the separation is more blissful. That's another succinct way of putting it. Got it right?
Seven, Yudhishthira reigns. Yudhishthira too now finds some peace, especially knowing that the son of Abhimanyu survives in Uttara's womb. The unborn child had, in fact, seen Krishna appear in his embryonic home to save him from Ashwatthama's mystic weapon. This remarkable vision set the auspicious stage for the child's birth and life.
The boy is born just as the zodiac converges to an ideal configuration. Delighted, Yudhishthira lavishes gold and land on the priests who praise the king's dynasty, and especially its latest addition. Pleased, Yudhishthira asks the priests to forecast the child's life. Noting that the child will be known as Vishnurata, or one protected by the Lord, the priests detail the child's fortune with a string of comparisons.
He will be as honest as Rama, who gave up a kingdom to honor his father's word. He will be as protective as Shibi, who gave his son's flesh, his own flesh. Sorry, excuse me. Who gave his own flesh to spare an insignificant bird. He will match Arjuna in archery and the Himalayans in strength. He will be as tolerant and fair as Yudhishthira and as generous as Lord Shiva. People will flock to him for everything. He will be as magnanimous as Rantidev, who gave away his first meal in 40 days to feed some unexpected visitors. He will nearly... 40 days, huh? First meal. He will nearly equal Krishna in all good qualities. He will be as patient as Bali, who gave up a kingdom to the Lord, despite his guru's orders to the contrary. He'll be as determined as Prahlad, who endured torture from his father in order to serve Krishna. And his children will be equally glorious.
The priests end with a description of the child's unusual death. He'll know of his death in advance and use the opportunity to give up his kingdom and seek Krishna. The learned Sukadev will help him at that time. Despite this odd conclusion, Yudhishthira feels great joy and relief to hear of the child's wonderful future. At last he manages to put the dreadful battle behind him. In great happiness, Yudhishthira performs an opulent Vedic sacrifice, just as Krishna and Bhishma had advised.
Eight, Dhritarashtra leaves home. Years earlier, when five sons of King Pandu, headed by Yudhishthira, lost their father, they were too young to assume the throne. Although his blindness disqualified him from full sovereignty, Pandu's older brother Dhritarashtra stepped in as a caretaker. His inability to discipline his own ambitious sons ultimately led to the tragic Kurukshetra War. After the war, which is with his sons dead, Dhritarashtra had no choice but to return to palace, a broken man, fully dependent on the compassionate Yudhishthira. Dhritarashtra's younger brother Vidura possessed a more saintly character. He left the palace prior to the war to immerse himself in pilgrimage through India's holy places. Now the war is over and Vidura returns to the palace to the delight of all.
During his travels, Vidura had passed through Dwarka and learned of horrible tragedies. As he recounts his journey to Yudhishthira and the rest of the court, he tactfully avoids the subject of Dwarka and Krishna, wanting to spare his nephew more grief. Once the bustle of his arrival settles and the palace resumes its routine, Vidura confronts Dhritarashtra in private. Your sons and well-wishers are all dead, your body is rotting, and you are living at the mercy of someone you tried to kill. Don't let death catch you in such a degraded position. Come, I'll take you to the Himalayas, where you can die a noble death.
Vidura's words cut straight to Dhritarashtra's heart, and he slips out of the palace without hesitation. Vidura guides him and his wife Gandhari, who resolves to accompany her husband in death. The next morning, Yudhishthira comes to greet his elders and finds them all gone. Sanjaya, Dhritarashtra's longtime secretary, joins the shocked king in his grief. Suddenly, Narada appears. Everyone raises in respect and listens as the brilliant sage explains Dhritarashtra's fate.
Narada first reminds the king that God and Krishna controls everyone. By Krishna's mercy, every creature finds something to eat. Narada points out that time is also dragging Yudhishthira toward death. How can he protect his beloved uncle from the same fate? Trust that Krishna has a purpose, Narada urges, and continue with your royal duties, at least until Krishna leaves earth. The prescient Narada, what does that mean? The prescient Narada then describes how Dhritarashtra, sitting by the holy Ganga, high in the Himalayas, will absorb himself in austerity and meditation. Within a few days, he will completely detach himself from ego and realize his true identity as spirit soul. The mystic force of his intense meditation will incinerate his flesh. Gandhari will throw herself in the flames of her husband's body, joining him in the yogic success. Witnessing this, Vidura will continue his pilgrimage, never to return to the palace. Yudhishthira hears all this in stunned silence. Assuring him that he has fulfilled his duty to all his elders, Narada takes the king's leave.
Nine. Lord Krishna disappears. Feeling anxious about the future, Yudhishthira sends Arjuna to consult with Krishna in Dwarka. However, the king's anxiety continues to build. Weather patterns are disrupted, and the citizens' collective character is weakening. Yudhishthira calls Bhima to his chambers and makes further observations. Krishna has made our success possible, he says, but Narada indicates he will leave earth. I don't know if that time has come, but many evil omens concern me. My body trembles and my heart palpitates. Jackals spit fire as they howl and dogs harass me. Donkeys circle around me and auspicious animals like cows pass me only on my left, an inauspicious sign. My horses appear sad. Cows no longer nurse their calves, and the bulls can't find any pleasure in the pasture. Even the birds seem to shriek messages of doom.
The whole earth and her climate has changed. Mountains seem to throb, and the sky is full of smoke.
Lightning appears out of nowhere, and violent winds bring dust and bloody red rain. The sun sets early, revealing stars that seem to be at war with each other. The rivers and lakes are on the verge of flooding. Prosperous towns have become depressed. The deities in the temples appear to be crying. Bhima, what is going on? Just then, Arjuna returns, pale, drawn, and in tears. Yudhishthira, keeping a brave front, asks about his visit to Dwarka. He inquires about all the Yadu heroes and Krishna and his family. Arjuna, however, does not even look up, so the king expresses concern for his brother. Arjuna, are you sick? Did someone mistreat you or threaten you? Did you fail in some duty or make a mistake? Did you mistreat a woman, a child, or an older person? Could it be that someone defeated you in battle? Or are you so devastated because your intimate friend Krishna has left this world?
Arjuna had barely been listening. With much difficulty, he composed himself and replies that, yes, Krishna has gone. Before going into details, he first strengthens himself by recalling Krishna's activities. Krishna helped me pierce the tiny fish eye target with my arrow and thus win Draupadi's hand. Krishna also rescued the demon Maya from the forest fire and encouraged him to build our royal assembly hall. When Jarasandha kidnapped all those kings, Krishna gave Bhima the hint that allowed him to kill the, what's that word, scoundrel? Scoundrel. What does that mean?
Rascal.
Oh, rascal. Krishna took me to the heavens when I won my Gandiva bow, and Krishna cleverly saved us when the powerful and easily insulted Durvasa dropped in for lunch when we were unprepared. In the great battle, Krishna helped us defeat all the miscreants, particularly those who tried to disrupt Draupadi. All the great warriors on the other side should have killed us, but Krishna intervened. Now all of them are dead. Krishna even protected me when I stopped and watered my horse in the heat of battle. How could I have treated him so informally and given him the duty of driving me around? He was always so warm and friendly. How can I live without him?
His feelings expressed, Arjuna is now ready to break the bad news. After Krishna left this world, I decided to bring his many wives back here for their safety. On the way, a band of common thieves attacked us. With my Gandiva bow, I should have driven them off in moments, but I couldn't stop them. Without Krishna, I, the so-called great Arjuna, became useless. Even worse, nearly all our friends in Dwarka are now dead. Due to a sage's curse, they became drunk on rice wine and slaughtered each other. All of this is Krishna's will, but it is also devastating. I must remember Krishna's words, just as he instructed me on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. With this, Arjuna withdrew into a sort of trance, absorbed in Krishna. He grew calm and resolved to give up this world. His mother Kunti, watching and listening to everything, also determined to stop everything else and simply serve Krishna for the rest of her life. Although the fate of the Yadus and Krishna's wives was much worse than he expected, Yudhisthira had long been prepared for Krishna's departure. Like Arjuna and Kunti, within himself he immediately renounced the world. However, as a king, he first had to make proper succession arrangements. He called for Vishnurata, whom he had been training for years, and installed him on the throne. Yudhisthira then entered a deep meditation, affirming his identity as a soul, not as an outward body. Mentally offering his very body back to the elements from which it came, he traded his silk robes for rags, loosened his long hair, and left for the Himalayas, his mind fixed on Krishna. His four brothers followed him. Soon they all entered Krishna's abode in their same bodies, a rare benediction. Their wife Draupadi received the same blessing. The saintly Vidura also died at this time, although unlike the fortunate Pandavas, he resumed his previous position as a god in the planets of heaven. This chapter ends with a palashruti, or blessing for the readers. So we're about out of time. I'll just briefly recap. We have these remaining chapters that we've read more recently. Should be more fresh in our minds. So from the chapter about King Parikshit, chapters about King Parikshit receiving the age of Kali, what do you remember? Anyone? A few things.
So he took up his chariot and his arms and rode out to see if he could find who was causing such disturbances. And I may be forgetting something, but he encountered Kali, who was disguised in royal garb, beating a cow and a bull. And so if, I mean, I could go on, but if anyone else remembers.
What does he say to the bull?
He asks him, who's doing this to you? I mean, clearly he can see who's doing this. But he asks the bull to tell him first, and the bull, he does not accuse the wrongdoer. And by that, Maharaj Parikshit knows that this bull is actually Dharma.
So then, Parikshit is approached by Kali, and what does Kali ask him?
I can't remember. I don't know. It's he asks him if he would give him like a place to stay, like so.
Right,
and
surrenders.
Yeah. He tells him he can't stay. But he gives them, like, four places to stay, like, basically the four things that break the regulative principles, and also where there's gold, he can be. Oh, yeah, true.
So then he collected all the gold in the kingdom and used it for sacrifice. It was a change up. Okay. So then after Kali gets his place, then what happens next? Who curses the king? Sringi, right. And how does the king take the curse? He was out hunting in the forest, and he came upon the hermitage of Shamika Rishi, who was meditating. And because the sage was so absorbed in meditation, he didn't know the king was there. Yes, it is, because they have to keep their martial ability sharp. So they practice on animals, but then the animals are taken back and revived. So that's actually good for the animals. They're given a fresh set of downs. The priest will perform a sacrifice and say mantras, and then the animals are resuscitated. So it keeps the Kshatriya sharp and the Brahmins sharp also. So that's why they're always hunting. All right. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Now you all know the entire first canto, right? Do you feel like you've imbibed all of this?